This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. A lot of people will tell you that athletes are not heroes, and those people are right. Of course they're right, and I'm often among them. But this week, we're going to set aside that reality to answer a fantastical question. It's summertime, which means the movie theaters have been filled with superheroes, and between Wonder Woman and her magic bracelets, Spidey and his tingling senses, and that baby tree that does nothing but dance, my producers started wondering, is it the special ability that makes a hero super, or is it the challenges the hero faces? A geeky question, if there ever was one, but go with us on this one. So this week we have four stories of athletes and their greatest challenge. First up, the story of a superhero in disguise who took off her Clark Kent glasses to do battle with her personal nemesis, self-doubt. Here's Only a Game's Karen Given.
In March of 2015, University of Kentucky track and field coach Edric Floreal had a problem. His most promising hurdler, senior Kendra Harrison, kept folding under pressure at big meets. Coach Flo, as Harrison calls him, had an idea.
Right before my indoor nationals, my senior year, he told me that I was kind of like Superman. You know, off the track, Clark is a quiet person. He has glasses on. Nobody really knows who he is. But, you know, when he puts his cape on, then he just transforms into a superhero. And he was like, that's what I need to do. I need to take my glasses off and I need to get on the line and run like the way that he knows I can, and just having that confidence.
And the crazy part is, it actually worked. Harrison won her first NCAA title. Then the track season moved outdoors and she kept winning.
Here's the number one hurdler in the college ranks, Kenny Harrison of Kentucky. Can anybody beat her?
You know, everything just started falling into place just by believing in myself.
What a future this woman has, Kenny Harrison.
In 2016, Harrison turned pro, and the wins kept coming. She won seven races in a row. In May, she set a new American record in the 100-meter hurdles. Her time of 12.24 was the second fastest time in history and within striking distance of a world record that had stood since 1988. Next up, the Olympic trials.
So everyone assumed, oh, it's going to be a piece of cake for Kenny to go out there and make that team. But, you know, getting on the line and actually performing, it was a lot. And it wasn't a lack of confidence like it had been in the past, but it was just more of just going out there and doing it.
And how do you hope this dream unfolds for you here in Eugene?
Man, you know, if it's in God's glory, I really want to make the team. I really think that I have what it takes to make the Olympic team, and I definitely want to represent the USA.
Harrison felt confident through the prelims, but in the semis, she came in second. It was the first time anyone had beaten her all season long.
It was pouring down rain, and Coach Flo was trying to say, okay, we got one more round. You know, shake it off. You're going to be fine.
But standing on the starting line, the voice inside Harrison's head didn't tell her to win the race. It told her, just finish in the top three. Just make the Olympic team. It was the first time in a long time that her goal wasn't to win.
The gun went off and I didn't get out as fast as I usually had. I realized I was in second, and then I was just telling myself, oh, just, you know, you're in second place, just stay right here instead of kicking it into gear and trying to win. And, you know, I settled for second, and then next thing you know, I'm in fourth and then fifth and then...
She's not even close. Brianna Rollins wins it with a time of 12.34. Kendra finishes sixth with a time of 12.62.
It was a hard day.
Wow.
Horrible race.
Wow. And afterwards, you had to face people like me.
Yeah, you know, you had to walk through the mix zone to get to your bags and things.
In the mixed zone, athletes can't escape the media. And for athletes who've just lost when they were expected to win, it can be torture.
So, you know, of course, all of them were surrounding me and asking me questions. What happened out there? Are you okay? Are you injured?
Not banged up or anything?
No, I feel great. I mean, I'm not injured. So.
If you watch that YouTube video closely, you can see how hard Harrison's working to keep smiling. Once or twice, her face drops and she starts blinking. And then...
I have lots of words right now.
Thank you very much.
I think I just walked away.
Harrison had no hope of going to Rio, but she had four more meets in her professional season. So she came up with a new plan. She would break that world record. Nothing else would do. 2 weeks after her disappointment at the Olympic trials, Kendra Harrison was getting ready to go to London for a Diamond League event. She says she was still a little shaken from that loss. That's when her phone rang. It was a former coach. The two hadn't spoken since high school.
I couldn't believe it, actually. And I was just, she was like, hey, this is Coach Sally. And I was just like, hi, like, I haven't spoke to you in a very long time. And she was like, yeah, you know, but I've been watching you and I've been watching your career unfold.
Coach Sally was calling with a message.
She was telling me, you know, I felt like God was telling me to tell you to keep going and to not give up on yourself. So, you know, that's all I needed to hear. I just turned my mind all the way around and just only said positive things and spoke it into existence.
Let's turn to Kendra, and sorry to raise it straight away, but you second fastest woman in history, but those American trials.
So every time reporters in London peppered Harrison with questions about what went wrong at trials, she came back with some version of,
the rest of my season, I'm going to go after this world record and win the Diamond League.
During warm-ups, Harrison ran some of the fastest times her coach had ever seen. He didn't tell her, though. He didn't want to make her nervous. In prelims, Harrison ran a blazing fast 12.4.
So running 12.4, I felt like my old self again. I was like, well, I'm back, and I'm ready for finals.
So you know that Kendra Harrison, Kenny Harrison in lane six, feels she has a point to prove.
I just remember myself pushing out the blocks and feeling really good, and going over the first couple of hurdles, I felt myself going faster, and I kept telling myself, keep going, keep going. And, you know, I just leaned as hard as I could. And
but here comes Harrison. Look at Kenny Harrison fly toward the line. 12.58, not quite as quick. Not quite as quick as in the heats. But she won by a huge margin. And she says once again, you'll be missing me in Rio. I am number one.
Harrison had won, but according to the stadium clock, she hadn't done what she'd set out to do. She hadn't broken that world record.
I remember looking up and I saw 12.5, and I was just like, Kenny, be grateful that you came out here and you won. And you just beat three of the girls that are going to Brazil. So, you know, I just thought positive thoughts.
But the clock was displaying the time for the second-place finisher. Harrison had leaned so hard at the line that she had ducked under the timer, and she didn't even notice when her new official time flashed up on the screen.
No, I mean, I remember the crowd, like, getting really loud, but I don't know. I was just like, oh, well, they're just happy that I won. And then I remember Nia Ali, like, tapped me on the shoulder and was like, look, Kenny.
Look at the clock.
Harrison called Coach Sally back and thanked her. And then August rolled around. Did you watch the Olympics?
Yes.
And what was that like?
It was hard, but I just took it as motivation. And, you know, when I was at practice, all I kept thinking about was the Olympics are on right now, so train hard because your time will come.
The Tokyo Olympics will kick off on Friday, July 24th, 2020. And Kendra Harrison plans to be ready. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Gibbon.
Just last weekend, Kendra Harrison came in fourth in the 100-meter hurdles at the World Championships, missing out on a medal by 0.02 seconds. She disagreed with those who suggested she should be disappointed with her performance, reminding reporters that she is, quote, still young, and saying that she will come back stronger. As I was thinking about this week's program, I found myself recalling a particular ball player I hadn't seen in a couple of decades. When I'd seen him pitch in what was certainly his worst day in the major leagues, I'd been inclined to regard him only with sympathy. But then I heard another part of his story from someone who knew him much better than I did and better than any of the people who'd ever bought a ticket to see him pitch. Back in 1986, when the Red Sox began to lose a World Series that had looked unlosable, Bob Stanley was on the mound for Boston, and he threw a wild pitch, unless it was a passed ball. Didn't matter. Lots of Red Sox fans came to regard Bob Stanley as one of the guys responsible for perpetrating what was then a streak of almost 70 years without a World Series championship. Ken Coleman was doing play-by-play for the Red Sox then. He'd been in the booth for a long time, and some years after that extraordinary World Series, probably because Ken Coleman had written a book, I had the opportunity to talk with him at some length. He met me after he'd come out of the dentist's office, and we talked in his car. He sounded just like he did on the radio, so he probably hadn't had Novocaine. Anyway, for some reason I don't remember, Bob Stanley's name came up. And maybe you remember him. Stanley looked more like the proprietor of a small-town bed and breakfast than a major league pitcher who'd signed a million-dollar contract, back when $1 million was serious money. And he knew it. He once said something like, "God gave me a great right arm. I wish he'd paid a little more attention to the rest of the job." I really liked that. And I guess I also mentioned to Ken Coleman that once after a speaking engagement, a guy in the audience who blamed Bob Stanley for that World Series loss had told me, "I got no more Stanley screwdrivers or Stanley files. I threw them all out. I hate them." When he heard that, Ken Coleman smiled and shook his head, and he said it was a good thing that guy hadn't said it to him. He wouldn't tolerate a bad word about Bob Stanley. "Why's that?" I asked him. "For years, I worked with a Jimmy Fund," he told me. "I was the guy who, when there was a child sick in the hospital, a kid with cancer, and we wanted to get a ball player to visit him, I was the guy who called the ball player. And Bob Stanley never said no. When I called him, all Bob ever said was, 'What room number? What time?'" That may not have been heroic. It may not have been. But it was good, wasn't it? I mean, every time. Not one time saying, "Hey, Ken, I got a lot to do. See if you can find somebody else." Just what room number, what time, and maybe, oh, what's the kid's name? Ken Coleman died almost 15 years ago. Bob Stanley last pitched in the majors in 1989, and the last time I looked, he was the pitching coach for the minor league Buffalo Bisons. And he sort of doesn't belong with the other athletes whose stories we'll tell today because, according to Ken Coleman, Bob Stanley didn't see what had happened in that World Series game as something he had to overcome. He already had it all together. Still, not a bad story to tell, maybe, in a show about how three people found their way to that end. For much of his basketball career, Bill Walton played through nearly debilitating pain.
"I just thought that everybody had these problems. I thought that everybody's feet hurt all the time. Everybody had a crooked leg. Everybody had a broken spine. That was just part of the price you pay."
NBA Hall of Famer Bill Walton, coming up on Only a Game from NPR. I'd like to thank Anna M1414 for leaving the following review on iTunes. "A weekly favorite. I've been a fan of Only a Game for years. The show has stories that make me laugh and cry, make me indignant and angry, as well as make me feel hope for the future of humanity. Love, love, love." Thanks, Anna M1414. We love, three times at least, receiving reviews like yours. Consider visiting iTunes and leaving a review of your own. It is the best way to help other listeners find our show. How should sports teams and leagues handle athletes who get into off-field trouble? That's the question for two of this week's three stories you should know. My guests are sports writer and editor Patrick Ruby via Skype and ESPN's Don Van Natta Jr. Welcome back to both of you.
Hey, Bill.
All right, it's good to be here.
Don, you lead off for us, please.
Well, Commissioner Roger Goodell suspended Cowboys star running back Ezekiel Elliott for 6 games. Primarily for Elliott's alleged series of domestic violence incidents against a former girlfriend 13 months ago in Columbus, Ohio. The fast and furious impact of the suspension, now under appeal, could go far beyond the Cowboys' Super Bowl chances this season. Now, no one is angrier about Elliott's 6-game suspension than Cowboys owner Jerry Jones. As some fans know, Jerry Jones is Roger Goodell's loudest supporter, and Jones is also the NFL's most powerful owner. At the owners' meeting in Phoenix last winter, Jones pointedly argued that all 32 owners should sign off on Goodell's next contract in 2019, not just a 3-member compensation committee. this could be seen as a not very subtle warning. So, in the last 2 years, Goodell's player discipline hammer has infuriated two of his most influential supporters, Patriots owner Robert Kraft, who was livid over Goodell's Deflategate punishment against star quarterback Tom Brady, and now Jerry Jones. The Elliott suspension has also damaged the already strained relations between the forever warring NFL and the NFL Players Association. This past week, the NFL accused the union of leaking information that shamed the alleged victim. The union leaders angrily denied it, calling the NFL's accusation a lie. After this season, league owners and the players' union had planned to begin negotiating an extension to the CBA that expires after the 2020 season. But the Zeke Elliott suspension and all its ugliness instantly makes getting an extension for a new collective bargaining agreement an even longer shot. The union head, Demoris Smith, recently said the chances of a lockout or strike are a virtual certainty.
In terms of a strike or a lockout, I don't think that the union is in a powerful or strong enough position to credibly have any sort of lengthy work stoppage. We've seen this before historically. They just don't have the sort of unity, the war chest, the ability to go without work and go without pay for a whole season or more. And I think the NFL owners know that. And I think a lot of what you see from Roger Goodell when it comes to the players part of it is essentially flexing that power. And by the way, power that was given to him in the 2011 CBA negotiations. We shouldn't leave that out.
The other thing that strikes me as interesting here is the feud between these two organizations. The NFL is angry because they say the Players Association has leaked material about Ezekiel Elliott and thereby polluted the entire discussion. And all I can say is that if somebody was to insist that I believe either a spokesperson for the league or a spokesperson for the Players Association, I'm going with the Players Association because the league has so often misrepresented what's going on and flat out lied that I can't really believe anything they say about this particular incident or probably anything else.
Well, I agree. If you're weighing the track records of the two organizations, certainly the union has scored more points on the credibility side. But what I find so fascinating about this is always these Roger Goodell disciplinary decisions come down to looking ahead. What is he doing politically? And in this particular case, Goodell not only is learning from the Ray Rice debacle of a few years ago, he did this far more methodically, this investigation. It took 13 months and it's far more thorough with the help of a panel. But he also helped himself because it was Jerry Jones's turn. There is a view among some owners that Jerry Jones has gotten too big, he's gotten too many benefits from Roger Goodell, and now it's his turn to get whacked.
Let's note one thing here. This is what makes it so classically NFL, the quote-unquote whacking. Who's the person that really gets punished? Again, it's a player. I think Jerry Jones is going to be just fine. Elliott, regardless of the circumstance of his case, he's the one missing game checks.
No, you're right. But Jerry Jones wants to win a Super Bowl in the worst possible way. He's just turned 75. He hasn't won one now in more than 20 years. And among the owners, it is seen, and the owners care far more about themselves than they do the players. They've certainly proven that over the years. And among the owners, this is seen as Roger Goodell really taking it to Jerry Jones.
Patrick, let us move on to your topic, please.
So I want to discuss this document that came out this week from the University of Minnesota's independent review of how the school investigated a report of a sexual assault involving multiple football players last year. Now, the document was reported on by Deadspin, and it's essentially a set of football team rules. It includes a list of, quote unquote, pitfalls around college athletes. Now, there's 15 of these, and in no particular order, they include traffic and parking tickets, no respect for authority, borrowing or stealing a roommate's credit card or phone, using a fake ID, plagiarism, and, by the way, last but not least, date rape / gang rape. Now, this is a little weird for a number of reasons. These are almost all things that college athletes and really everyone else should not do. They seem pretty self-evident. I am not sure why football coaches really need to remind players of this stuff.
Because they keep doing it.
Okay, well, secondly, it's very weird that you have a list of things that are mostly actual crimes or at the very least academic misconduct. And it also includes, quote unquote, no respect for authority. I mean, only in the mind of a football coach is that somehow in the same universe as theft and gang rape. Third, we should talk about the date rape and gang rape part. I do not know how you are just casually tossing that into the same bucket as parking tickets. That is actually beyond weird. It's really disturbing. But I do think it says something about how and why football coaches, athletic departments, as we just talked about the NFL, sports governing bodies are just so very, very bad at trying to act as moral arbiters or as an alternative justice system. They're not professionals at this. They're professionals at sports. Nobody would suggest having detectives create game plans, but somehow we constantly want our sports powers that be to address problems that are way outside their lanes. And I think we do this because it makes us feel better as fans. Then keep pretending that sports are escape.
The list is so ridiculous. Number one is parking tickets. Hmm. Yeah, the date rape and gang rape is down at number eight. It's almost as if they put, you know, these 15 pitfalls in a hat and pulled them out. And also on this memo, there is the line, treat your body as if it were a Lamborghini. I mean, who wrote that? I mean, a Lamborghini?
A Lamborghini salesman.
Right. It is the same list, you know, warning about date rape. The whole thing is so tin-eared and ridiculous and should be mocked, you know, from coast to coast.
Well, I agree. And I think the problem with the list starts with calling these various things pitfalls. And unhappily, it's very easy to mock what these people at the University of Minnesota have done. It's very easy to mock the fact that they, as you say, have tossed all of these things onto the same list. But unfortunately, I think it's probably representative. I think Patrick is absolutely right. We can make fun of this, and we're probably not going to make a dent in this mindset by doing so. Patrick, have I got that wrong?
No, I mean, it is something to make fun of, but I want to be clear. I'm also kind of not making fun of the football coaches who came up with this list because, like I said, it's so outside their lane. It's not really their department.
Yeah, but some of this is common sense.
It is.
Some of this is so simple, it's common sense.
Absolutely. I mean, that's what I'm saying. Like, you know, the coaches should basically, I hate to say this, they should stick to sports and let professionals in these other fields deal with the other stuff.
All right, I want to lighten things up with my topic for this week. On Tuesday evening, I was at a ball game between the Red Sox and the Cardinals, and the Red Sox turned a triple play. And I don't think there's any series of acts that more clearly demonstrates how good three players have to be. The guy sitting next to me, season ticket holder, old friend, probably been to more than 1,000 games, he jumped up and shouted when he saw this. Home runs are great, pitching duels are tense. I wonder, though, if there's any sequence of events in baseball more extraordinary and more fun to watch in that split-second way than a triple play. Patrick, tell me I'm wrong.
I mean, I like when people steal home. So I'm going to vote for that over triple play. But I think triple play is a close second.
Don, triple play fan?
I am so jealous that you were able to witness the triple play in person. And the only thing that I'd be even more jealous if you had seen is a natural cycle, which you know, is the single, double, triple home run and has only occurred 14 times in Major League Baseball history. That's even rarer than what you saw. But no, you witnessed an amazing thing, and I'm extremely envious.
I accept your envy. It was great fun. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been sports writer and editor Patrick Ruby and ESPN's Don Van Natta Jr. Thank you, both of you. It's been fun for me.
Thanks, Bill. Likewise.
As always, thanks for having me.
Let us know what you think of Only a Game. Subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a review. You can also join our online community on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. Basketball Hall of Famer Bill Walton recently wrote a book. Here's how it starts.
Summer, 2009, San Diego. I can't do this anymore. It's just too hard. It hurts too much.
Walton played through chronic pain during his three-year college career with UCLA and his 10 seasons in the NBA with the Trailblazers, Clippers, and Celtics. 22 years after his retirement from the pros, the pain had become much worse. That led him to despair.
There's no reason to believe that tomorrow is going to be any better. If I had a gun, I would use it.
Happily, he didn't have a gun. Bill Walton provided me with a short history of his long list of orthopedic problems.
I was born with structural congenital birth defects in my feet. I tore up my knee when I was 14, I broke my spine when I was 21 playing for UCLA. So here I had this wrecked body that I was trying to chase the dream of being part of something special. And I just thought that everybody had these problems. I thought that everybody's feet hurt all the time. Everybody had a crooked leg. Everybody had a broken spine. That was just part of the price you pay.
The rewards for the price Walton paid included two national titles with UCLA and then an NBA championship in 1977 with the Portland Trail Blazers when Walton was just 24 years old. Lots of players would envy those accomplishments, but the young Walton wanted more.
I wanted to be the best. I wanted to win everything, and I idolized Russell, Wilt, Oscar, Kareem. But my body would not carry me to my dreams. On April 18th in 1978, when I was the most valuable player in the NBA, I took a pain-killing injection in my foot. And when I went out and tried to play on another broken foot with a pain-killing injection, the bone in my foot, it split in half. And I spent the next 8 years of my life chasing the dream.
Walton reunited with that dream as a member of the 1986 Boston Celtics. They beat the Houston Rockets in the finals. That team featured fellow future Hall of Famers Larry Bird, Robert Parrish, Kevin McHale, and Dennis Johnson. Walton, then 10 years beyond his MVP season, was still with the team the following year when the Celtics were losing to the Lakers in the finals. He was in uniform, but his injuries kept him on the bench.
And I can't play. I haven't been able to play all year because I have another stress fracture in my foot and I can't go. And all I wanted to do was help the team win, and I couldn't do my job. And so the fans in the Garden, they just were cheering and chanting and wanting me to get back out there as if it was a matter of effort. And every time I used my foot, the bone would break more. And so I'm standing there on the floor in my uniform, the critical moment of the series, of the championship, of the game, and the fans are chanting my name and it's my turn. But while I'm standing there on the court, I'm just so alone and it's just so desolate and it's dark and things are spiraling helplessly out of control and there's nothing that you can do. And it's just the most depressing feeling in that you're letting your guys down, you're letting your team down, you're letting your town down. And so while I'm there, the fans chanting, Walton, 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 the place just reverberating. Dennis Johnson came up to me and he put his arm on my shoulder and he inched up and he whispered in my ear, don't do it, Bill, don't do it.
Bill Walton's NBA career ended in 1987, and he did some math. Over the last 9 years of that career, he'd not finished a single season able to play. Happily, he retained enough of a sense of humor to smile at how relatively fortunate one of his contemporaries had been.
I went as an invited guest to Kareem's 50th birthday party, and I hadn't seen him in a little while, and he shows up with a cane and an orthopedic boot on. Kareem, the most durable athlete you've ever seen. I mean, never missed anything. And he's got this cane and a boot. I said, Kareem, what happened? You haven't played basketball since you were 42. You're the first 20-year player in the NBA. What happened? How could you possibly have gotten hurt now? What were you doing? He said, oh, man, Bill, the doctor, he had to carve on my little toe. And it's really, really painful. I said, well, so, Kareem, how many operations is this for you now in your life? Bill, it's my first one. I've had 37 orthopedic operations.
Walton had his worst days well after he'd stopped playing basketball. After collapsing as he got off an airplane, he spent much of 2008 flat on his back, unable to get off the floor. In 2009, he sought help in innovative spine surgery.
I was lying in that hospital bed February 8th of 2009 and going to go underneath this incredibly risky and tough surgery. And I'm lying there, and I'm thinking, I'm not coming out of this. And you know what? I don't care if I don't come out because this is just not worth it. And the doctor, Steve Garfin, and he's patting my hand next to the gurney, and I'm all hooked up to all the tubes and everything. And Dr. Garfin is saying, you know, I'm going to do my best. There's no guarantees. And oh, my gosh, I was so afraid, and I was just had tears, and I thought it was over. And so as I hear Dr. Garfin call out across the room to the anesthesiologist for the count to start the drip. I've had a lot of operations. I know what that command means, that I've only got a few seconds. And so as the anesthesiologist, I can hear his voice from across the room as he starts it, and I can feel it coming into my veins. 10, 9. And I reached out with whatever and little strength that I had, and I grabbed Dr. Steve Garfin's forearm. And I looked up at him. I said, "Please, Doc, please fix me. Please save me. Please give me one more chance."
The recovery from that 8.5-hour surgery required an induced coma, months on powerful painkillers, and tedious rehabilitation. And how's he doing now? I'll let Bill tell you.
And I am just doing fantastic. And to be in a life now where I have no pain, I take no medication, I'm just getting started, Bill. I'm the luckiest guy in the history of the world.
Bill Walton's back at work as a TV basketball analyst. He swims a lot at the San Diego Y. He says with an enormous smile that he's in love. He smiles a lot these days, no doubt because for a long time he felt he'd never smile again. Ahead on Only a Game Boxer, Heather Hardy was hooked from the first time she stepped into the ring.
I felt like a million puzzle pieces came together and just told me, this is what you're here for. This is your life.
But she'd soon take on a bigger fight against her entire sport. That's just ahead on Only a Game. And remember to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Once upon a time, there was a podcast. A podcast that told stories, especially for kids. This podcast gathered folktales from around the world and found amazing actors to bring them to life, including some you might recognize from movies and TV.
Dear wise old woman, you are a genius!
Yep, that's Jason Alexander from Seinfeld.
You won't believe this!
I'm Rebecca Shear, and this podcast we're talking about, it's a real thing. It's called Circle Round. And whether you're a kid, a grown-up, or young at heart, we're coming your way this fall from the WBUR iLab. Hear the first episode now on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And come circle round on our website, wbur.org/circleround.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, a much-beloved golfer teams up with Devo to make great art. But now it's time for my discussion of the week's news with Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
On Wednesday night, Yankees slugger Aaron Judge hit a 457-foot home run, and then he set an all-time MLB record for consecutive games with a strikeout by a position player. Best of times, worst of times is just too easy here, isn't it?
Consecutive games with at least one strikeout by a position player in one season.
Mm-hmm.
That's a heck of a line in the old record book right there.
Maybe two lines.
It might actually be two lines and an asterisk.
On Tuesday night, Tiger second baseman Ian Kinsler was ejected from a game after arguing balls and strikes with umpire Angel Hernandez. But the real fireworks came when Kinsler blasted Hernandez, saying, quote, he needs to find another job. I hope this story has a happy ending.
It actually does. But Kinsler also said, I'm just saying it's pretty obvious that he needs to stop ruining baseball games. How could it be subtle that he needs to stop ruining baseball games? I don't understand. Anyway, the day afterwards, they shook hands. And now that's pretty much the end of it until, of course, the next time Angel Hernandez calls Ian Kinsler out on strike.
Exactly. Charlie, this week, Red Sox owner John Henry said that he is haunted, his word, by the racism of former team owner Tom Yawkey, and that he wants Boston to change the name of Yawkey Way, which is one of the streets that runs
right
along the side of Fenway Park. Is this likely to happen?
It's also the money-making street. It's
yes,
the street
it is.
That's
they
been,
close
that's
it during
been closed
games.
Down, and you get your beer and you get your Italian sausage or your lobster roll or your whatever. Yeah, I think that's a great idea. I mean, the Tom Yawkey, I mean, as we've always said on this program, there never was a curse of the Bambino, but there really was a curse of Jackie Robinson. I think it'd be a great idea, and of course, there are 9,000 different suggestions now as to what you should change the name to. Yeah, I think Bill Lee Boulevard sounds pretty mellifluous.
I would go with that. And Bill would, too.
He would.
I'm quite sure.
He'd be out there with a broom every night after the game, making sure his street was clean.
The Detroit Red Wings moved swiftly to disassociate the team from the right-wing ralliers in Charlottesville who had displayed versions of the Red Wings logo. The team said it vehemently disagrees with this use of their logo, and they are exploring legal action. Is legal action likely to work in a case like this?
I have no idea, because I've never seen...
How do you prevent
somebody... How did this happen? Apparently there was a group from Detroit who appropriated the famous... You know,
the wheel with the wing.
And, I mean, once again, you know, hockey's out in front on this stuff. Hockey is for everyone is capitalized by the NHL because they've been so far out in front on the diversity thing. You know, I hope they can sue and I hope they win.
The U.S. Open tennis tournament begins next week and Maria Sharapova is back. She was given a wild card for the tournament. Good idea?
Yeah, I think so. She'll sell tickets. She's a good player. She's been having some arm trouble, apparently. She won the Open in 2006. I think it's good that she's back.
Yeah, I think you hit it with point number two, which is it will sell tickets.
Oh, no question.
24-year-old Justin Thomas won the PGA Championship title last weekend. All kinds of good angles with this one. Son of a former PGA pro, part of golf's so-called youth movement. So, does he save our golfs?
He's one of the people who will save our golfs, yes. It was a tricky round. I mean, he had to hold off a few folks in the back nine, and it's another win for a golfer who is not Tiger Woods, which is proof, again, that the sport has moved on.
The women's college basketball season will not begin for a couple of months, but UConn has been preparing in Italy, twice beating the Netherlands national team. UConn did not win the NCAA title last season, so they're taking it out on Europeans.
Yes, now they're going to beat entire countries until somebody stops them. Planets are next, by the way.
Mm-hmm. The numbers are in, by the way. South Carolina's women's team led the country in attendance last season, and, of course, they did win the national title, so new powerhouse.
Well, certainly new box office powerhouse, and, of course, I'm sure everyone's excited to see those two teams play again. South Carolina probably already has that Netherlands scouting film teed up.
Finally, Charlie, the rally
cats.
Cat. The rally cat was apparently found by a St. Louis area animal group, so the cat is being taken care of. But what's this contention that the Cardinals are using bullying tactics regarding the cat? I thought the cat was the bully, the way you put it last week.
Well, the Cardinals, being one of the most disgustingly self-righteous sports franchises we have determined that somehow the animal shelter had agreed to give them the rally cat back. But the shelter is saying no, and they're tired of being bullied by the St. Louis Cardinals, and I hope the cat is adopted by a nice family in the Yukon so we can get far away from its unexpected fame.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time, and he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Heather Hardy is a boxer, and so you might expect this next story to be about the toughest opponent she's faced in the ring. But Heather Hardy's toughest opponent, her arch nemesis, if you will, isn't another fighter. It's the boxing industry itself. Heather Hardy tells us her story in her own words.
When I was a little kid, I was the biggest Yankee fan on the planet. And I really used to dream of running out of the bullpen and pitching like the eighth and the ninth innings and closing out a World Series game. And they didn't let girls play Little League. And I remember feeling sorry, like, why do I have to like baseball if I can't do anything? Why do I have to be a girl? After I had my daughter, like, for everything on paper, it looked like I should have been happy, you know? I had my daughter in preschool, I had a husband with a pension, I had health insurance. I mean, everything was so nice. But I felt like I was missing something in my life. Like, I would drop my daughter off to preschool and felt like, I can't believe I don't love this. And I felt like, am I a bad mother? Am I a bad woman? Am I bad at being a wife? Because I didn't love it. I didn't want to talk about coupons and go out for brunch with all the other moms. Like, I wanted to go back to this little karate school where I was taking classes and I could just be Heather. And I was taking these little kickboxing classes, or they put the radio on real loud and you jump around and hit the bag. And after 3 weeks of taking these classes, 3 weeks ever having gloves on my hands, the fight instructor asked me how much I weighed. So I told her, and she says, well, there is a kickboxing match in 2 or 3 weeks, and do you want to do it? And so much was missing in my life. Like I had this empty hole. I thought, why not? Why not? I'll do it. So here I am, the shyest girl in the world. Like, I'm the girl who will walk into a room and sit by myself. But for whatever reason, we're walking through that crowd of 2,000 people with the spotlights and the radio on and standing in that ring and beating this girl up so bad. I felt like a million puzzle pieces came together and just told me, this is what you're here for. This is your life. Very shortly after my first fight, went through a divorce and was like, leave. And he finally said, fine. And he took everything and he went. And I had Annie at home. I was working up to 6 jobs just to put food on the table for my daughter. My sister was living with me with her son, and she also wasn't getting child support. It was satisfying because I had mentally told myself that I was gonna make it, that I knew I could make it, that I had to get some more jobs, but I would do it, and we did. I mean, there were days I came home where we didn't even have 2 eggs to crack, and my sister would always joke about it and take my daughter with her little fake play shopping cart over to my mom's to go grocery shopping at grandma's house. When you have a kid and you have to do it, you figure it out. I just kind of evolved from the kickboxing. I had lost a fight. And the girl that I fought, she barely even kicked me. She just beat me with a jab and a right hand. So the next day I went back to the karate school and said, you know, I will train 2-a-days, 3-a-days all summer. I want to do the rematch. Teach me how to beat her. And the coach at the time told me, "Hana, I don't want to disappoint you, but you got to accept that this sport isn't for everybody. Some people got it and some people don't. And maybe you just ain't one of them that got it." I kind of went home thinking like, man, maybe she's right. I still had a fire, you know, the same fire that I said, something's missing, I have to find what it is. I took a lot of time off, but so much of me was missing, not boxing, kickboxing, fighting, that I said, I got to go to Gleason's. I got to find a coach and find out if it's true. Within a year, I was ranked number 1 in the country as a boxer, so I guess I did have it. After I won the 2012 Golden Gloves, I came to the gym. And I said, all right, I'm ready to go pro. I won everything I want to win as an amateur. And one of the guys from my gym, we call him Blimp, he's a big guy. Blimp's son was signed with DiBella. Lou DiBella is probably the biggest boxing promoter on the East Coast. So he said to me, I'm going to talk to him for you. So he came into the gym next day and said, listen, I could get you a fight on the card. But you gotta promise me you're gonna sell 10,000 in tickets. I guarantee them $10,000 in ticket sales. So I said, all right, I'll do it. And he looked at me like I was crazy. I said, no, I'm telling you, I'll do it. I don't care how I'll do it, but I will do it. My promoter was paying me $800. I sold $13,000 in tickets for my first fight. A lot of the girls told me just know going in that this is a hobby. This isn't a life. You do this because you love it, but you'll never make any money off it. I had that same feeling, like, why did I have to be good at this? When you have networks, big TV networks, who are saying that they're not ready to air female fights, it makes it hard for the promoters to put us and invest money in us because promoters make money when they get their fighters on TV. So for my whole career, I kind of just swallowed it, that I have 2 jobs. I have to win my boxing fights, and I have to sell tickets and market myself. Then I fought in June on the Sean Porter and Keith Thurman undercard, which was going to be on NBC, and I had this big pitch. You know, Ronda Rousey made millions because Dana White put her on a pay-per-view card that millions of people were going to be purchasing and tuning into. The public had no chance but to either love her or hate her, and they loved her. And my thought in June was, tell me, what do you think would happen if Heather Hardy showed up and fought before Keith Thurman and Sean Porter? Would people turn off their television sets? And everyone kind of laughed about it, like, that's never going to happen. We're never going to do that. And I fought on the undercard, got another nice win. It was kind of like, oh, Heather's just never satisfied with what she gets. And then I kind of turned into that woman, the woman who was always asking for more. It was really discouraging because it seemed to me like everyone was missing the point. It's not about me. It's about all the other girls who are doing this who deserve a chance. Like, what don't you guys get? I finally backed off and I just kind of shut up and thought, you know, I'm always the one that's calling. Hey, I heard this one's fighting. Put me on the card. Oh, I heard this one's fighting. Put me on the card. And I said, you know what? I'm not going to make any more phone calls now. So I was kind of toying with the idea of switching to MMA. I was kickboxing again. And then I got a call from Lou DiBella himself. And it was about midnight. And I was drinking wine and eating pizza. And he says, I got something cooking. I said, is it going to be on TV? He said, I'm working on it. I threw that pizza down. It was back to running my miles.
Presenting Heather the Heat Hardy.
I was fighting Shelly Vincent. She's also an undefeated fighter from Rhode Island. We had a lot of people there. Pretty much packed the venue with people dying to see this fight. Other than to say I was super satisfied knowing that we were on television, didn't feel any different. That bell rings. Punches in the face are still the same. One thing about this girl was she was so tough. She kept the fight through right to the end. And I won. And I beat her. And that was probably one of the most satisfying moments of my career. No freedom till we're equal, you know. My fight on August 21st was the first female fight televised on a PBC show, which is a long list of things that I've been the first female to do. Heather Hardy was the first female to fight at the Barclays, the first female to fight on the undercard of a PBC, the first female to fight on TV. You know, I want to be the first female to make some money doing this like the boys do. I'm not going to stop, not because I'm not satisfied, but because until the playing field is equal, you can't stop. I can't be satisfied with, okay, we gave her enough. Enough isn't enough for me. All of this has been so that my daughter, so that no one's daughter, has to feel like they're sorry that they're a girl. And if I could give anything to my own kid, it would be for her to see how hard her mom fought to make a future for her and to make it so that things are a little bit different the next go around.
That's boxer Heather Hardy in her own words. Our story was produced by Only a Game's Karen Given. We talked to Heather last September. In June, she made her MMA debut with a third round TKO of flyweight Alice Yager. After the fight, she told reporters that she had fallen in love with MMA, but that she's not going to give up her quest to convince boxing promoters to feature women in their fights. Her next MMA fight has already been scheduled for October, and she's been described as an instant fan favorite. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. We had help this week from Renee Marchando, Mike Toda, and Mike Moschetto. Our senior producer is Karen Given. We say goodbye this week to intern and fidget spinner delivery man Philip Goldberg. Thanks for your excellent work, Philip. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game, and thanks for listening.